Bienvenidos. Welcome to this evening's program. On behalf of all of us, I'd like to thank the Youth Committee for having invited Mr. and Mrs. Dunbar to share with us tonight precious experience they've had while pioneering in Central and South America. Many of us already have had the opportunity to get to know them a little bit in functions at the World Center, but for the benefit of those who might be recently arrived, let me give you some background information. I promise to make it short so we don't cut out on time on those inspiring stories. Mr. and Mrs. Dunbar come from California. They were born and raised in California. And as a young man, Mr. Dunbar worked as an actor. He was a stage and screen actor and worked with major companies like MGM and 20th Century Fox. In 1958, he... All this until 1958 when he decided to go on pioneering and he went on to Nicaragua. But little did he know that the whole of South and Central America was going to be his home for 15 years to come. And likewise, Mrs. Dunbar, as a young lady, decided to go pioneering and she went to Central America, to Honduras. There also she took some, enrolled in some university studies. Through this time, they corresponded with each other and they eventually got married and continued to serve the Blessed Beauty as pioneers until they were called to serve in the Holy Land when Mr. Dunbar was appointed to the first International Teaching Center in 1973. And then in 1988, as you know, he was elected to the Universal House of Justice. So without further delay, let us give them a warm welcome. Mr. and Mrs. Dunbar.
To the Youth Committee to invite us, and I don't know where you found out all that information about us, but anyway. You know, we were thinking, well, all right, we probably could tell a few stories, but what would be the most useful for you? Just to start off, if we do, what is pioneering in any case? What is pioneering? And that reminds us of a tablet of Baha'u'llah written to a woman in Persia who was burning to go pioneering but had not the possibility, being a woman and in the situation that she was in. And Baha'u'llah addresses her and says, "Be thou a pioneer to the country of the love of God." He said this has priority over physical movement and travel, which in a way tells us that the simple act of moving one's body from one country to another is not pioneering. That along with this is there's a requirement for traveling from an old self to a new self, if you would, as Horace Holly said once. Going from one condition to another condition. Arising and embracing the promises and assurances of the Lord. Putting those promises to the test, if you will. Shoghi Effendi challenges us to arise and put to test those promises. Placing yourselves in situations which, unless you trusted in God, you wouldn't ever get yourself into. And letting God arrange things around you in such a desperate manner as to assure you that without his help you couldn't go forward. Pioneers over and over experience the closing of doors around them, the apparent lack of assistance at the beginning of any endeavor, and the need to persevere and push and convince God that you're really in this for Him and for nothing else. And He also in the process convinces you that you're only in it for Him and for nothing else. International pioneering, of course, is more meritorious than homefront pioneering, but both are pioneering. And if one is not able to enter the international field, or for various reasons it finds themselves with possibilities to pioneer in their own country, in their own homeland, still wonderful processes are set in motion through such a thing. The international field offers many different kinds of pioneer lives, if you will. Places you can go, challenges that you can accept. I think because Marilyn and I went out when we were very young, we liked the challenging places. Now sometimes we talk about it or think about it and we say, boy, if I had to go back and do the same thing again, I don't know whether I could do it at this stage in life. There is a certain readiness in the very youthful stage of life which allows one to address those kind of challenges. Pioneer or study. The House of Justice, in its letter to the youth of the world, which is in both the first volume of its messages and the second volume of the messages, gives the guidelines of the House of Justice on that subject. And I'm going to attempt to paraphrase it, but you have to go back to the original and see it, because it's very delicately balanced. Essentially, it says that if you can't bear to give up pioneering to study, then you should go pioneering. But if you can study, you can also, through study, prepare yourself to pioneer. But it doesn't mean that we should say you must study first, when your spirit and outlook may be such that you're not predisposed to study at that stage, at that particular stage in your development. And that may not mean that you'll give up study forever. Perhaps by going out, travel teaching, or short-term pioneering for a year or more, just as coming here will reorient you, will allow you to focus on that which would be most beneficial in your study, will motivate you to learn what you need to learn in order to sustain yourself in the pioneer field, or prepare you for a career in which you could work internationally, or all the other possibilities that would be open to you. Sometimes, at the first rush and thrill of the excitement of serving and teaching the cause, you don't want to lose that. You want to explore it. Maybe it won't be possible for you to pioneer, but maybe you will go for a summer teaching project. Something that gives you a period of sustained service to the cause, similar to what you have here, but added to that the fire of sharing the message, of spreading the divine fragrances, of witnessing the response of breathing life into the souls of others, which is an experience once tasted, as many of you already are familiar, changes the course of your life. It turns the inner being, and that desire for that savor, for that closeness to God and to Baha'u'llah that teaching brings to the heart, becomes the animating motivation, if you will, of your life. Without travel teaching, without pioneering, you may attain to that, but the prospects are so much greater if you do enter this field of service.
I don't have anything else to say.
I told Hooper I'd be happy to come along tonight as long as he talked and I would just correct him.
I'm sure she has some corrections already. The benefits of pioneering. The station of pioneers is very great. If you're pioneering, you don't want that to go to your head, but you sometimes need that kind of encouragement. You don't have to share it with others, but you absorb it from the writings. You know, this is important what I'm doing. It doesn't seem to be important, and nobody seems to give a hang about what I'm doing, but this is important. And when you read the writings, and don't leave your books behind if you go pioneering, thinking I won't have time or I'll buy the books in the language of the country I'm going to and that will force me to learn the language. You may dry up and wither in the meantime. You will want to have, especially now they have these smaller editions of the major books of the faith, you'll want to have them along because they will become your companions and they will help you to stave off loneliness. Because sometimes pioneering is a very lonely affair. Why is it lonely? Surrounded by people, you often go to countries where the people are very warm-hearted and welcome you. It's because the experience of pioneering is different from the experience of the people where you're going. In other words, the very fact that you've left your culture and gone out for the faith, that you want to focus your attention on service of this nature makes you different from the other people, and you're experiencing your hopes, your aspirations, your vexations are of a different character. Usually people want to share their joys and their sorrows together, but you'll find in the pioneer field when nothing seems to be going forward, if you're in an isolated post, that there's nobody to really talk to about it. There's no Baha'i there with you if you happen to be in a place where you're by yourself. And I think that both of us, have preferred to go to places where there were no Baha'is to start teaching. Our experience was that way. We opened new places. Then somehow you feel that Baha'u'llah doesn't have a choice about assisting you because you're the only one there. And you say, well, Baha'u'llah, it's either you assist me or this thing's not going forward. And I know I'm not the best vehicle and instrument for this, but as soon as there's two people, you pray for the other one to do it. You know, yes, <we're out. laughs> one of the besides this idea, when Shoghi Effendi was speaking with the pilgrims here, he mentioned about the pioneers, and he said that the station of the pioneers was very great, and he said the pioneers have been mentioned in the Quran. And he referred to a term in the Quran. Of course, the word muhajir, pioneer, is in the Quran, the muhajirin. But also, there is a group of people called the mugharribin, which means those who enjoy near access to God. And Shoghi Effendi has even translated, those who circle round the throne of God. Those who have access to God. He said the pioneers fulfill this reference to the mugharribin in the Quran. The pioneers of the cause are the ones that enjoy this close access to God. It's that character of service. And Abdu'l-Bahá says that in the time of war, the commander, the general, is not concerned with the aide-de-camp and the other people helping in his office, the ones that are immediately with him. His thoughts are with the soldiers in the trenches, the ones that are on the front lines. And it's that way too. I mean, if you think the response that the House of Justice, of course, is pleased with your services and that you're here and you're supporting, and that has its own special role. And in a sense, at times, the House says it even has priority over pioneering, because there's special needs here. Anybody can pioneer any place, but not anybody can fill the staff positions here at the World Center. The pioneers in the field have the advantage of learning something about the plasticity of the human spirit. You know, when we grow in our own culture and we see the way everyone responds around us, that society views life, the way that society views religion, the way that society views morality, perhaps. When we go out into another culture, we see a whole different range of human reactions. And they say how different they are. And by the time, particularly if you have any kind of a variety in a pioneer career, you're going different places and seeing different peoples and experiencing different cultures, you begin to realize that the culture that you had and that you got stuck with, if you will, isn't the way you have to be. That you can alter yourself, that you see then greater possibilities of conforming yourself to the standards and example of the teachings, and realize that this is possible. That I'm now in a culture where people naturally are patient with each other and soft-spoken for the most part. One doesn't have to be aggressive and forward. There's all of these various things occur to us in teaching situations and in the pioneer field. And it's painful sometimes to realize that a lot of our identity is an acquired identity that we could just as well do without. And sometimes people in the pioneer field will tell you that they could do without it too. Yankee, go home. This is a reality that one faces in different places. And it isn't because of your Baha'i qualities that they'll be telling you that. I think that's fair to say. The Baha'i qualities endear you with people and attract them to you, except some of the clergy who may be upset for other reasons. Also to the pilgrim, Shoghi Effendi said we should be very careful teaching. We should be cordial and cautious with the government officials, especially when you're starting in a new place, so that there won't be misunderstandings of what the purpose of the faith is, and so on. But he also mentioned in one case, and of course this is a pilgrim note, but he said, be reckless with missionaries. You don't have to be cautious with missionaries. If they attack and fuss around, to some degree that can be helpful. That doesn't mean you go out of your way to provoke them, but don't be corralled by them, so to speak. I was once invited to speak with some clergymen about finally accepting us as a part of life on the Nicaraguan coast. They, several years, didn't want to accept that, but when they saw that we were making encroachments in areas that they considered their assigned regions, that was a Baptist region after all, and this was a Moravian region, and the people in those areas were really, we have an understanding, and we can provide you with a region, but don't go in our regions, you know. This kind of message was tried out on us. And of course, with our view of progressive revelation and all these things, we weren't able to subscribe to such a thing. We said, well, all the people really need to hear about Baha'u'llah. According to our teachings, that's our position. And sometimes we pass and see the clergymen wringing their hands in the windows of their houses as we passed in the streets. It's, where are they going now? What are they going to do today? Who are they going to talk to next? You know. The benefit of getting to know yourself, moving out of the comfort of being surrounded by those that support you as family, as friends, those that may have needed you for their own selves or that maybe sincerely loved you, and the separation from that causes you to have to detach yourself and cling to Baha'u'llah. We know the purpose of life is to know and love God. And pioneering assists the soul, assists the heart, assists the mind in that accomplishment in ways that very little other acts in life can rival. Must have something to say now.
Just a couple of points about things that you've said. One thing about the loneliness of pioneers on occasion, I wanted to balance that out with also your deepest friendships for life, at least in our experience, are forged in the pioneer field if you have the opportunity to be a pioneer. I think probably in most cases people's deepest friendships are forged in common suffering, or yes, really in common suffering. It doesn't have to be a negative kind of suffering, it can be a positive kind of suffering, but somehow the roots of the friendship go very deep under those circumstances. And one other minor thing that I wanted to say, also Hooper said that the Guardian had told the friends that they could be reckless with missionaries. I would modify that by saying depends what the situation of the faith is in that country. If you're the only Baha'i in that country and by being reckless you're going to get yourself thrown out, then maybe you shouldn't be reckless. You should also be wise.
Why don't you tell us how you decided to pioneer?
Well, I was just sitting here thinking any merit that has to do with pioneering is in my future and not in my past, because I went pioneering with my mother, and all of the sacrifice was on her part, not mine. I was a young person and I was delighted to go out and do something exciting, but she was the one that had to sell her home and all of her possessions and take the step off the edge of the cliff into the great unknown, not me. And also I have never suffered particularly from loneliness as a pioneer, because I went from my mother's home to my husband's home. So those things are ahead of me still. Yeah. My own merits as a pioneer.
Can you say a bit about what your mother did? Because of her.
Well, I helped my mother to pioneer. I think I prayed her out of a job because I wanted to go pioneering, and she was being very practical, and she was saying, no, after you finished your education, we can go. And I didn't like the sound of that, so she lost her job. and then she got a job in the pioneer field teaching at an international school, and so we went. And my mother is an extraordinary person. She was an extraordinary pioneer. She's very adventurous and very determined. And she was all by herself most of the time, because I was only with her for about 4 years. Then we got married and went off to other regions. She traveled all over the country. sometimes by muleback. One time a mule fell on her on a steep incline of a mountain, and she got up and walked to the village. One time she fell in a river on her way to a village, and she was all wet. Everything she had was wet, and she was so cold. The beds are, in that part of the world, are a wooden frame with leather thongs crisscrossing. And she said she had a candle, so she lit a couple of, I guess she had a few candles, she lit the candles and put them under the bed. That was the only source of warmth she had, and she kind of huddled over the warmth of the candles trying to dry out and everything. She's a tough lady. She really is. And I know years and years later, people would go off, pioneers would go off to teach in the remotest corners of the country, and they were sure that nobody had ever been there before. They were going to open this new area. And when they would open their mouths and say bye, people would say, "Oh, and how's Juanita George?" So, yeah. She was a stalwart pioneer. Dr. Jacare called her a gallant woman, which she was. She eventually got too old and confused, and she had to come out of her pioneer post. And when I took her back to California, where we came from, she was very upset with me, and she said, "Why have you brought me to this foreign country? You took me out of my home, and you brought me to this foreign country."
She served for a quarter of a century, and she opened most of the departments, the provinces of Honduras, to the faith, a number of the remote ones, and was one of the first people to teach the Indians. Well, they were the beginning teaching Indians. In fact, one group was of Mayan extraction that were still in togas, living on a place called Flower Mountain. Very romantic place. We went there. That's actually where some of the connection between us was strengthened. I don't want to get into that part because she'll correct me a lot on that.
Just one more word about my mom's comment about why have you brought me to this foreign country. That's what pioneering will do to you. And that place becomes more your home than where you started.
Every fatherland becomes a foreign land, and every foreign land a fatherland. Where is that in the writings? It is in the writings. Okay, so don't remember. Are you sure?
Okay, there's one more thing. It's just parallel to what you were saying about the broadening of one's horizons and the experiences with different cultures. Some of you have this without pioneering because you're the product of a mother from one culture and a father from another culture. And I think that also it's the same idea, and it's very beneficial. It reminds me of something that a friend of mine who's a specialist in the learning of languages told me. He said that if you learn more than one language as a young child, even if you should not have the opportunity to use one of those languages and you forget it, it still opens circuitry in the brain. It opens pathways in the brain that makes learning in general easier for you, particularly the learning of languages and other learning. And I think that this is true of our experience as Baha'is in general, that it broadens our horizons so much, but particularly one's experience as a pioneer. And it makes all subsequent learning, it broadens your framework so that you have more places in which to fit significant bits of information that you gather at later stages of life.
My not worrying about having children in the pioneer field, or
that's one thing, but just in general, for one's own benefit too, I think that it has its difficult moments, but it has tremendous long-term benefits. It's very exciting and very learning enhancing. Lousy term, but
it's a great challenge to go to a country with a foreign language and have to have that language to teach the faith. Obviously there's a period of intense adjustment and learning, and it's a very painful experience, I think, for most people, unless you're in a happy family or something like that. But if you're really isolated, I was isolated in a boarding house where nobody spoke English, and anything I needed, I had to have the little book and try to pronounce the words and be laughed at, and it was just very, very painful. And about the same time, I became very ill. And another element of pioneering is coping with illness. Because if we're going to run home to our home country, as soon as we get sick, because they say, well, how can I serve if I'm sick? I can't stay here. I can't do this. You finally realize that unless somebody stays there and is sick, the work is not going to get done, because there's certain areas where people coming from abroad are going to be susceptible. There's no way to avoid being infected by amoebas in some of the areas. And the people are all infected with them, but they're more accustomed to it because they're born with that and in the environment, and whoever wasn't strong enough isn't there anymore. So the question of coming in and getting sick when you've maybe been a healthy person is a major challenge. And I know in Nicaragua, when I first got there, when I first got sick with parasites, I mean, it's a very depleting, it's very debilitating. It's like, you know, if you're vomiting and you have diarrhea and it just goes on for several days and days and you don't know how to check it, you soon lose all zest, certainly all starch, and end up wondering what you're doing there. Now, I remember, there's no Nicaraguans here, I guess I can say this freely. I remember coming and loving the country and so enthusiastic, you know, and it took about 3 months of being ground down until I had this terrible apprehension that something was about to attack me from behind. And I'd live with this and I try to avoid it, and I would read and think. But when I got sick, there wasn't that kind of level of inspiration. So when you get sick with a flu, you know, your prayers don't feel the same. Nothing quite uplifts you. And here I was very ill, and I was dragging myself back and forth from one of these cots to a bathroom and getting to the point where I didn't know how I was going to survive. Well, finally some other pioneers came and got me and took me to a doctor, and they gave me some injections so that I could have hepatitis along with my illness. Well, about that stage, one day I was sitting reading prayers and meditations, and I could feel this thing coming again. Here it came. And what the thing was the question, was that terrible reality that I'm afraid I don't like pioneering. I'm supposed to love pioneering, and I don't like pioneering. And I'm a failure as a pioneer because I don't like pioneering. And just at that time, this voice came and said to me, "Who said you had to like it?" And it gave me a new lease on life. I realized, I don't have to like it. I don't have to worry about that. I'm doing it for Baha'u'llah's sake. It's better if I don't like it. It doesn't matter. Do I love these people? I don't love these people. Do I like anybody in this country? I don't like anybody in this country. I'm only here for you, Baha'u'llah. That's all. I'm here for you. Well, after that, I actually began to like the people. So So when you feel yourself up against the wall and you say, what am I doing here? What madness is this? Try to remember that you don't have to like it. You're not going there for your good pleasure. You're going there for His. Now, ultimately, it all comes out the same. You will find that, as Marilyn says, your greatest friends, also your greatest memories, your greatest joys are all associated with those difficult moments and the suffering that you had together. And that moves you. It remains a treasure within you for the rest of your days. And it creates connections with you. Maybe you'll dream about the believers in those areas, because you saw them come up from nothing and take life and move and go out and teach and become pioneers to other countries in some cases and enter into mass teaching projects and attract believers who have come here and served at the World Center even. There's just no way to describe the treasure that all of that is in a person's life. If you should be so lucky as to go to an area where people are receptive on top of all of that, that's an added joy. But that's also, there's a certain illusion to that, you know. I'm a successful pioneer. Not like those people in the other country, they don't have any new believers. Well, you should go to the other country and try their shoes for a time. Another bit of advice, if you go out somewhere and you get in a country and you find that, as we have found, people came pioneering there, they came to us to complain. They said, we came pioneering, we've given up everything. The Baha'is didn't even come to the airport to meet us. We went there, you know, we're supposed to consolidate this community and the local assembly. They didn't even come to the airport to meet us. We had to go into that town alone, and nobody really cares whether we're there or not. Yes. That's why you needed pioneers in that area. We needed pioneers in those places, not where the believers are full of joy and service and will welcome you and draw every breath of inspiration from you, but where there's no life in the community and it needs something else. And that's why you're there. Okay, then sometimes you have people, they cannot bear the place they are. Maybe they can't bear the heat, or they can't bear the cold, or they can't bear the altitude. Instead of thinking it's either here or Milwaukee or, you know, Frankfurt, think there are a whole lot of countries. Africa's that way, Latin America's that way, Asia's that way, and now the whole ex-Soviet Union is that way. You move some distance, you can either go higher or lower geographically, and you have a different culture, a different people, maybe even a different language, and a whole other outlook on life. This is a broad generalization, but just to give you an example of this. The people of Argentina, in general, particularly in the cities, if you want to talk to them on a bus or in public somewhere, and let's say the natural thing is to talk about the weather, you have to say something like, my God, can you see the weather? I mean, who can stand this? And they say, yes, it's so hot, or it's so sticky, or it's so cold, or it's so sooty, or something annoying me. And then they understand, you begin to talk about common problems you have with life and so on. In Brazil, the country next door, you say, what a beautiful day, isn't it a gorgeous day? And the people said, yes, que bon dia, such a beautiful day, oh. And then you start talking about it. It's an entirely different outlook on existence. You have to find out which country suits your personality. If there's one that you can't bear, if you're not able to move right away, try to visit conferences and summer schools in neighboring countries. Get to know the scope of the whole situation. Then there's the difference between the rural setting
And the city setting. You may go to a country and be in a city and you say, I can't bear this. This is the same as where I came from. And why? How are we going to get anybody to be interested in the cause? Well, try to get out into the countryside. Try to see rural people and visit tribal people and have that experience. Maybe you'll find that you'll have a special role there. Particularly youth, because the fact that you're literate in so many areas already gives you a tremendous plus. You know, that you can read things to the people, you can share things from books with them, or you can help them and the youth there to learn to read or to memorize prayers. Can you imagine what it means to go in and spend a couple of days in the village and teach them the short obligatory prayer, those that want to memorize it? All you do is repeat it over and over and drink mate or coffee or tea or whatever they serve, and you just repeat it and repeat it, and then they have this. And the strength that that gives them. Consolidation is as simple as something like that, that they can fulfill one of these laws of Baha'u'llah, of daily prayer. There's so many different ways to serve. It doesn't require great brains all the time. You've all got great brains, I know, but it's a quality of service. It's the Baha'i attitude towards others that propagates the faith. And there are teachers in the field that will help you that won't know how to repeat any of the teachings. There was a fellow in one place we were that he used to go and enthuse people in the teachings, and he'd bring them to learn about the faith. He'd say, I want to hear about this new religion. So he said, well, what did you say? What did you say to him? And he said, well, I told him there's this new religion. It's really great. And he said, well, who? What's the name of it? He said, I can't remember. Well, who's the prophet? Well, I don't know. But, I mean, I know, but I don't remember his name. But I come with me, and I'll take you to these people, and they can tell you all about it. And because of his excitement about it, they would come. Now you'd say, well, how can a person teach? But they do. They teach like that. They attract. You say the prayers, people move around, different things happen. That's hard to correct, isn't it? Now, your turn. Is it long enough that you want to open for some questions? You might have some questions. Yeah. Is that okay? Sure. Is that okay? We were thinking about half an hour. It's been 40 minutes, so... If you'd like to ask some questions. Give me a hint. What? You know what cucarachas are? Do you remember a story like that?
The Rio Coco?
Must be the Rio Coco. One time, yes, I got a certain madness in me and went off to the border between Nicaragua and Honduras and decided I would try to go from the center of the country to the sea, which was all remote forest land. And people said you shouldn't go in that area because they have what they call bulpes, which are these pigmentation spots, both light and dark spots that people have all over them. And they say that they can give you these and you can't get rid of them, and anybody that comes, they give it to you as a favor so that you'll stay with them, because if you have them, you won't want to go anywhere else. Or they don't like you, so they give it to you just because that's... So they were warning us off. But anyway, I knew this was a remote area and that there might be tribal peoples there that had possibly hadn't embraced Christianity. Or we were very taken by certain statements of the Guardian where he said that during the World Crusade, the faith would reach peoples who in hundreds of years, Islam and Christianity had never penetrated. And we did some of that in Nicaragua, actually, among certain tribal people. And so, I'm not a very good writer, but I managed to get a mule to go from Jinotega, which is up in the highlands of Nicaragua, down to this river. It was downhill, and it was a tropical area, and the road was mainly mud. Some places, 2 feet of mud. It was that kind of slush all the way down the hill. And it was hard to get this mule to go down the hill. I think he understood that he'd have to come back if he went down. And every once in a while he would stop and I'd have to prod him and get him going. And then I noticed that one particular part in the road, he decided to start running downhill. And it was only near the last moment before he ran under a thorn tree, which would take me off the top of him, that I realized what his plan was. And I had a big rubber bag. We didn't have any plastic in those days. We had a bag that you would pour hot rubber on so that you could have something a little bit waterproof to carry thereafter. So after that, I walked down the road in this slush till I got to the riverside. There were some people there in a canoe that wondered what madness had possessed me and where did I come from and why was I there, because there wasn't anything else there but the river and the road and me. And so they said, well, where are you going? I said, well, I was trying to go that way to the sea. Well, they'd never been that way to the sea, but they lived down that way. They said, we'll take you to a village that's down the river. You come with us. So I hitchhiked with canoes down this river. And when we came to... We came to one particular tributary that emptied into what was called the Rio Coco in Spanish or the Wonky River in English. And there I met a captain or a chief of a tribe up this other river, and he invited me to go there when I told him what I was about to talk to the people about the Baha'i teachings. And so we started up this tributary upriver, paddling. I mean, we're not talking about boats with motors or anything. We're talking about dugout canoes and rough wood paddles, you know. So we're paddling up this river, and I noticed that his mother has spots all over her arms and hands, and she is reaching into some leaves, banana leaves, and taking out an orange-colored kind of bubbly thing and put it in a calabash, a half of a calabash, and then dipped that in the river, and then put her hands in that and made this mass part of the liquid, a rather thick drink. And I realized I was seeing the beginning of the ritual called Supa Bunya. This is a drink that's made from a certain salty type of date that grows in wild palms in the forest. It's collected. It's then chewed by the women and spit into banana leaves where it sours. And that's the basis of a very popular refresco, a drink which is given to honorable guests. And everybody else drinks it too, but the honorable guests, they find that's a good way to test their sincerity. So I'd been warned, if they offer you this, of course you will accept, because otherwise you're going to be in trouble. So back this calabash came with about 3 liters of this fluid in it. And I started drinking it and explained to them that I wasn't used to drinking so much. My stomach was very small, but I did drink. I must have drank about a liter of it, I suppose, before I passed it around and I found others would then drink from it if I'd drunk from it. And it had a really unfamiliar taste, if I could say that. And I thought I was going to fall prostrate in the little canoe after I drank it. And immediately it connected with my other bodily chemistry that it began to bubble and boil inside of me. I wondered where it was all going to end, really. Finally, we got to the village, and the villagers all came out to the landing. The chief was coming, and he was bringing a white guest. And this is from, I mean, where? They hadn't seen anything. It was really a room. I'm talking now about four days into a river that has very little population, and then up another river that has nothing but an Indian population. So we're really far away. There was no regular missionary service of any sort there. It was remote. And when I stood up, I realized that I would have to avail myself of some kind of sanitary services and began running away from all of the people, trying to explain in some language they might understand that I have to go that way for a little while. After having been properly sick and fighting off about 10 pigs that were chasing me, I came back to the village and they had prepared a hammock for me to lie in, having some idea of the state I was in. And then they brought me another, now it was in a glass of this orange stuff. And I looked at it and I thought, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go on with. And then the lady said, orange. And I looked at it was freshly squeezed orange juice. And that was the last I saw of Supabunya, so I guess I passed the test. And we spoke with those people about the faith, and then we began going down the river and visiting other mosquito Indian villages, their mosquito coast. I don't know why they call it that. There are a lot of bugs in the area, I can tell you. That was the only place that I could really say that I thought that the insects that bite were unionized, because there were certain colored ones that came out in the morning from about dawn until 8 o'clock, and then they disappeared, having been thoroughly fed. And then there was another little red-headed variety that came out in the middle morning, and then all of the different colored horse flies, the bright emerald green ones and the gold ones and the orange ones, and they kind of dominated until mid-afternoon, in which the shiny, sleek black and blue models came out, and then they would go on into the evening until it was dinner time, when everyone would again come out together. And this was not a question of hitting bugs, it was a question of wiping bugs. Well, after a couple of years of that, actually your system begins to turn. Take hope if you're in one of these areas and your fingers swell every evening when you're out trying to talk to the contacts about the faith. And you come home and you feel like you've got arthritis because so many things have bitten your hands. And you've put the different kinds of suggested substances to chase them away, including kerosene and every other bad-smelling thing you ever heard of. Then you go to bed with your mosquito net and hope that it will keep the rats from carrying your pillow away. When we got married, with two of us in the bed, they didn't borrow our pillows anymore, but they would come and they would eat the cords holding the mosquito net up, so that in the middle of the night, in the dark, in a house that has no electricity, you hear them pulling the cord up into the attic, the little roof, after having chewed it off, and the mosquito net's fallen down on you. And of course, if a mosquito net is on you, the mosquitoes are happy to bite through that to your flesh. Having gotten up and strung that, getting back to bed, that's awakened the pigs that sleep under the house, who scratch their backs on the cross beams of the bottom of the house. It was about six or eight of them we had. And when they did that, the whole cabin would shake. Then they would feel quite comfortable and would relieve themselves. This is to give you some picture. There is no end of colorful experiences surrounding pioneer life. Then I would tell Marilyn, why don't you go get the water? In the morning she would get up and go 100 meters for a pail of water to come back, because we didn't have any water in that house, along with not having any electricity, nor any screens, nor any windows. I remember one of the dear Baha'i friends wrote, heard I had had parasites. She said, you'll have to take care of yourself, dear. How will you serve? She said, first of all, wash the vegetables before you eat them. And second, don't let even the shower water get into your mouth. Well, there was no plumbing, and I hadn't seen a shower in months. I used to bathe in a water hole, and there were no fresh vegetables for that matter either. I asked the doctor, why do I keep getting sick? I take the pills, I get better, then I get sick again. He said, it's the dust that you breathe carries all of these parasites. So as careful as you are, you'll still have problems. Now there's some better remedies for these things now. And I must say, since then, we found out about homeopathy, which is a big help if you learn something about it, to be able to take mild remedies that are effective for a lot of these type of things. Well, that's enough of naughty stories. Why don't you tell him something inspiring? Or another naughty story, if you want. I don't know if that's the story you heard. It's probably not, but that... Next question. Good, very good.
All the exciting things happened to Hooper. He attracts them. I think it's his actor background.
It just didn't seem exciting to her. Some good snake stories, actually. It's been a long time, really.
How did you learn the language? Did you know ahead of going before going?
Well, myself, I studied, but I can't really say that. I took 2 years of Spanish in high school, and I created a series of ingenious dodges to avoid going to class. And I became friends with the teacher, and I used to have lunch with her and discuss various things that she wanted to discuss. And she said that I was such an intelligent young man, it seemed a pity not to let me out of high school just because I hadn't learned Spanish. And I thought to myself, I don't like Mexico. I'm not going to ever go there. It's a dangerous place. And certainly I will never need Spanish. But they told me that was the simplest language to get around in high school, and that's what I did. So by the time I got to Nicaragua, I had thoroughly forgotten everything I ever knew. And I had a little piece of paper when I landed at the airport where nobody met me either. And this little paper said, del arbolito una cuadra al lago, which I'd looked up in the little dictionary I had, which said, from the little tree, one block towards the lake. And I somehow wondered, in this huge city, how the taxi driver would ever find this place and how I would ever find, without a house number or anything, the people that I was looking for. Well, I gave it to the man, and he didn't bat an eyelash, seemed perfectly clear to him. And he drove off and through the city, and I looked at all the various sights, and we drove through the market and saw all the colorful surroundings there. It was very hot. It was a tropical Nicaragua, and there were a few volcanoes belching on the horizon, and it was just like a movie, except that it was hot. And there were smells that I'd never smelled before. So as we came out the other side of the city, the road was entirely blocked by a huge tree that was about a block high, and the driver turned around and he said, El arbolito, that's the That was the little tree. So that was obviously was a landmark in the whole city. And then he turned one block towards the lake, and I understood that because the lake was down that way. And he let me out on a busy street corner with my bags, and I didn't know where I was, and I didn't know who to ask. And he saw that I looked completely befuddled. So he began speaking to people in the street and on the street corner, asking about, si no hay gringos por aquí, si hay un gringo que vive por aquí, este señor está buscando los gringos. This man is looking for the gringos. Isn't there any gringo around here? And they said, there's one down that street, but watch out, she has a bad dog. Perro malo. I understood that much. So finally I found the Witzels, Donald and Mignon Witzel, who took me in and nursed me through those first experiences of pioneering. So I really didn't have it. And I had to learn the language, and I wasn't very quick at it. It took me about 3 years, and being elected to a national assembly that I couldn't understand what these other people were doing, and I was suspicious. So I listened very carefully, and gradually the language went in, and gradually I understood what they were up to and was able to contribute something and cooperate with them. But it was a bit of a challenge to serve on an assembly that you didn't know what was going on. I mean, that may happen to you without a language problem, but that's another evening's discussion. Talk about learning the language. You should answer the question from your point of view because we didn't learn it together.
Well, I had 1 year of high school Spanish. I did go to class. And I was lucky in that my teacher was a native speaker, so I started off with exposure to a good Spanish accent. However, high school Spanish is not a very great foundation for really learning a language. When I got to Honduras, I couldn't speak the language, and it was embarrassing for me because people were asking me questions and so on, and I couldn't answer, and it was just awful. I'm kind of a shy person to start with, and that was excruciating for me. So after my first horrible experience, I retired to my room for 3 months. And every day I would read an article from one of the popular magazines of the day in Spanish. I would force myself to read an article every day, and I would use the dictionary as much as needed in order to understand what the article said. And at the end of the 3 months, I came out and enrolled in medical school. So that I had a crash course in Spanish with that. And it was fine. I didn't have any problems. But I had a lot more exposure than Hooker did because he went very shortly to an English-speaking area of Nicaragua. The whole Caribbean coast, as many people are not aware, is English-speaking. And so it took him a lot longer to learn Spanish because he didn't have the opportunity, except at National Assembly meeting.
Yeah. Well, there was some exposure. There was a population that spoke Spanish, but you could get away with ignoring them and just speaking to the people from Caribbean background. And they were African descent for the most part. And the Indians in that area had been missionized by Anglicans when the Mosquito Coast was a British protectorate. So they spoke a very kind of quaint form of English that would surprise you sometimes with the vocabulary that had come down with the tribe and which was different from the Caribbean. Not really a pidgin English, but almost a pidgin English that was mixed with some Spanish. It was a special. I've mentioned in the class a couple of times about how you had to translate English to another form of English in order for people to understand because their vocabulary was very limited. And when Dr. Muhajir was there, he was telling them about Baha'u'llah being the glory of God, and I was supposed to, he'd said it in English, and I was supposed to translate it into something the local people would understand, and we were teaching in a new village. So the way that you would convey that is that Baha'u'llah, him one man got plenty light in the face. That was the kind of simplicity that you had to come to convey to it. Now, these people had their own language, which was a very rich language, and I'm sure you could have said this very elegantly if somebody had known how to translate it into Ramo. But nobody knew how to translate it. In fact, they had pretty much lost, in this particular tribe where we were, had lost this. But anyway, that whole village became Baha'is during Dr. Mohajir's visit, and that was the first Baha'i village in Nicaragua. So those were the challenges.
What did you tell that for? Because I think that's really useful, the way Dr. Mohajir spoke to the people.
Yes, he came and asked us about our teaching methods, and of course we had some Indian Baha'is, but I was feeling very guilty about saying that I hadn't been through the Will and Testament with them. Because that was a requirement where we became Baha'is. You know, sometimes you carry requirements from one place to another and you never get it straight, that things are different in different places depending on the capacity and possibility of the people. Now, the vocabulary of the English Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Baha was beyond anybody there to understand it. It was beyond me to understand. The concepts, never mind getting those across. To be able to say that you'd read the Will and Testament with someone would have been a supreme act of endurance, one which I was never able to, probably providentially, able to inflict on anybody. So I would tell the stories of the Will, and that was the best I could do. And of course, that was really the solution. But I wasn't sure whether that was correct. I was a new pioneer, and I'd been in the area, and these were the first people that had come into the faith. So Dr. Mohajir said, no, that was fine. He said, the guardian said, this important thing is to create in them the love of Baha'u'llah. And if you see that spark of love for Baha'u'llah is there, you can bring them in. But then continue to visit them and teach them and add to their knowledge and protect them from others. And he was visiting the town, and we wanted to take him to visit these people that had become Baha'is. And he said, what else is up that way? And he said, well, there's several villages, and we visited them and so on. He said, what's the other way? He said, we don't know. He said, let's go the other way, down the coast. We were talking about going up the coast or down the coast by canoe. So we went down the coast on an open lagoon first till we arrived to an outlet of the rivers and the lagoons into the sea. And then we began walking down the beach next to a mangrove trees that were reaching out into the water. Well, as the tide came up, there wasn't any beach, so we ended up climbing through the trees for some hours until we reached an area where the forestation ended, and it was more grassy and more sand to walk on. So it was quite an exhausting day's trip, and we finally came to a place that was called Wearing Key, and across this sound, this lagoon, an inner lagoon, beyond the sea, beyond a strand of sand, were some traces of smoke coming out of the forest. And we'd taken a couple of people from the town with us that knew the area, so they began hollering and calling across the lagoon. And after some time, someone came out in a little boat, which was big enough for only one person, really, to check out to see who we were and what we were hollering about. And then Dr. Mohajir said to tell the people that we want to talk to his people, that the doctor has come and he wants to talk to the people. So they said, all right, they would go and they would get a bigger boat, and they came and they brought us and took us to this settlement of, was about five houses. And they said most of the people were upriver, so he sent a canoe. He said, go, please go and call them so tomorrow we can all talk together, that he had an important message for them. And the people went and they came, and I guess there were about 25 the next morning there. And that night, Dr. Mohajir had an asthma attack.
and he didn't have his medicine with him. And he was really feeling he was seizing up and he couldn't breathe. And Ruth the Pringle was on that trip also. It was before she was married and she was with us. And, we put everything we had, sheets and blankets, to warm Dr. Mahajir. And he was on a bench, one of these beds that didn't have leather but had sticks or boards across. The only thing is that the boards were not full length to fit the frame, so that if you moved it all on them, one side of one of the boards would drop down onto the floor again. And I was sleeping under the bed. So when the boards would drop, then it was my job to push them back up and put them in place. And there weren't enough mosquito nets to go around, as I recall, that night either. So we did our best, and he managed to wheeze his way through the night, and in the morning he got better. And then these people came, and now that's what I was saying. Nothing ever happens without some tremendous amount of crisis and suffering before it happens. When the people came, they all sat around, and they were very, they lived in the bush. They weren't used to having visitors. They were very kind of shy and looking down and feeling, you could see them muscular even. They were strained to be there, but they were there. So he set about relaxing them before talking to them, really. And he would have had to see the setting to understand how natural this was in the setting. He just very quietly said, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. And he smiled. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. And he said to each one, Allahu Akbar. They were looking down. They were beginning to look up, and he said, can you say Allahu Akbar? This is very important. Can you say Allahu Akbar? And one man got his courage up and he said, Alfa fa fa. That's right, Dr. Mohajir said. Allahu Akbar. That's right. Allahu Akbar. And everybody began, and I don't know why the Alfa Fafa stuck with him and the Allahu Akbar didn't quite get connected. But, so a lot of people were saying Alfa Fafa, Alfa Fafa, all together. But that was creating a spirit in the room and they all participated. And he said, you know what that means? And that's when he said, glory of God. And what does glory of God mean? And that's the man that got plenty of light in the face. So he went on. And he told the story. He said, you know, we come here to tell you that the first time God, who made everything and everybody and made all the people, he put all the people by a river, like this river here. And they were all one family, and they all loved each other. And they lived together so with such sweetness and kindness. It was wonderful, he said. But they had to eat, and they had more children and became more people and more people. So sometimes they'd had to make boats and go up the river and hunt and bring back food, or go down the river and fish and bring back food. And gradually they built little places where they went to hunt so they could stay more days. And then they went further to find more things. And the other people on the beach went down the beach. And they went down and they stayed. And then they came back to see the family and everybody came together. And then some went down there and the young people stayed there and they had children there and they didn't come back. And gradually they kept spreading and spreading in different directions and living in different places. And a terrible thing happened. They moved so far away that they forgot that they were one family. And Baha'u'llah has come to tell us we're one family. No need to fight. No need to hate. We should help each other. We should live together as one people in the world. And now we've come from different nations to come to tell you that we are all one family because of Baha'u'llah.
And the teaching he brings us is how to be close to God and how to be close to each other. Well, basically, this was the sense of what he said. And he told other stories, but of that, in a very simple approach, from his own experiences in Mentore Islands, in Indonesia, and from traveling so many different places. And these people became wonderful Baha'is and finally became delegates to convention and took part in activities. And two other small villages became Baha'is shortly after that. This was in the early 60s, still during the World Crusade, and this kind of thing wasn't happening very much anyplace. It happened in Africa, it happened in Indonesia. Nothing had happened in India yet. It was very early. Was that the one? Do we have time for another story or a question or something? I mean, yes. Oh, my, it's over time. But why don't you say a few closing words? What's your advice to these young people with regard to pioneering?
If you can do it, do it. I don't think you'll regret it.
I hope you're not going to say when we get in the car, why didn't you tell them something? Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you very much, Mr. and Mrs. Dunbar. These stories have been not only exciting, but very inspiring. And may we truly use this precious time here at the World Center to prepare ourselves so we can move from that old self to that new self, like you were mentioning at the beginning. And may we all go pioneering to the country of the love of God. We'll close with a prayer, and after, everybody is invited downstairs for refreshments. Thank you.